Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Do you wish you knew the saints better? Overwhelmed with all the events in Catholic history and just wish you could tie it all together? It's tough work, and even scientists have determined that it takes approximately 400 repetitions to create a new synapse in the brain, unless it is done with play, in which case it takes between 10 and 20 repetitions. Introducing Saint Cards, where the facts about saints and history are presented in fun and engaging games for ages 4 to 104. Check out Saint Cards at saintcards.com and begin the fun for your family, school, and parish today.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Presidente de Ignatius Press is here this hour. It is open forum on Catholic Answers Live. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, this hour is for you. If there's something you'd like to know about the sacraments or the Bible or the hierarchy of the church and why we do the things we do and why we believe the things we believe, this hour is for you. 888-318-7884. And we always encourage, if you are not Catholic, do not worry about it. Do not be shy to call. If it's a little bit of a challenging question, that's fine. Or if you just have a curiosity about what we Catholics are up to in there, 888-318-7884. When I say El Presidente, I mean the president. As a matter of fact, everyone who says El Presidente means the president. That's what it means, just in a different language.
It's true.
He is the president, of Ignatius Press, one of the largest and certainly among the most respected Catholic publishers and distributors of videos and music in this part of the known galaxy. He's a former apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of...
many things, but... specifically in this context, you tell me.
I'm scared. I just realized, I'm going to do it again. I haven't done it for like a year. And
starts with
the seven deadly sins of apologetics.
You got it.
It just seemed too easy. For those who don't know, I used to give every time Mark was on, I gave the wrong title to his book. And then I was just about to say it and I thought, no, that's wrong. You're going to get it wrong. And I panicked. Sorry, Mark.
Which would be, understandable, somewhat understandable, if it were an Ignatius Press title. But as it happens, it was published by
Catholic Answers.
Catholic Answers.
Yeah. So then that's particularly it's particularly bad if you do that.
Wait a second. I'm getting a call here. Yeah?
He's taking a call.
Yeah, I know. He does this every time.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
Okay. Oh, man,
right,
I'm in trouble.
I'll tell him.
Oh, no. Was that Todd?
No.
Who was that?
Higher authority still.
That was either Chris Check or Pope Francis then.
It was Pope Francis.
He was. He's calling to complain about me again. Oh, man, Mark, come on.
I bet you didn't know he listened, did you?
No, I did not know he listened. I don't think he would appreciate some of the things some callers have said about him on occasion.
Well, he's listening in Spanish, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, so he's listening. Well, I did say El Presidente at the beginning.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark, it was very nice to see you recently at the Religious Ed Congress in Los Angeles. That's a very interesting.
I was the keynote speaker.
You were not the keynote speaker, and I did not understand why they had the keynote speaker they had, but I will leave that for them.
That's kind.
But it's wonderful to see Ignatius Press there. I feel like you got to be there. You have to be there with the Ignatius Press products because and just to fly the flag because it's a very strange time to be Catholic, and there, not everything that's presenting itself as Catholic is.
Well, that's true. I'll say that we've been in that situation for a number of decades, and in some ways the situation has improved. In some ways it's not as good as it was. So, but I will say this, I'm glad you're glad we were there, and I'm glad that you were there. It was great
go
to see.
On.
Yeah. No, so we were there. We had our Ignatius table there, and then right across the way we had the Augustine Institute, which was wonderful because there are partners in so many projects.
Right.
And then just a little ways down the road from the Augustine Institute was Catholic Answers.
Yep.
So that was great.
And around the corner, just between you and me, I won't tell this to anybody else, there was a booth for Relevant Radio, a wonderful Catholic radio network that doesn't air Catholic Answers. And I went over to see – because a lot of my very – very dear friends worked there. So I went over to say hello.
That's right.
And this woman who was standing there at the booth just talking with them, she sees me coming. She goes, uh-oh. I was like, come on. You don't have to say uh-oh.
Here comes trouble.
Like, I'm not coming to wreck the place. We're still friends. So
you're looking for Father Rocky, right?
Yes, I was. Right. I had my brass knuckles on, and I was looking for a brawl. It was like, yeah, it was like the Warriors. And the movie, not the basketball team. 888-318-7884, the number here. Lots of people with lots of questions. Mark, shall we?
Shall we? Let us do so.
Let us into the breach. Sean in Albany, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. You are up first this hour, Sean. Your question for Mark Brumley.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. How are you gentlemen doing this evening?
Great, Sean.
Well, I'm doing pretty well for a sinner. I'm in a sinner recovery program called Lent right now.
That's great.
Right. A sinner saved by grace, right?
Amen.
Hey, I got a question for you. I was wondering, and it does concern me, I guess, to encapsulate the whole thing, Medjugorje and all the different apparitions of Mary, all the prophecies that are attributed to Mary, how does the Catholic Church know for sure that these are apparitions of actually Mary and these are not demonic deception? Very strong question, I know.
Okay, well, the church reviews the circumstances under which these alleged apparitions occurred. First of all, looks at the people who alleged to have received them, looks at the content of the apparitions. What are the apparitions saying? What are they asking people to do? Is there something in the apparition, the alleged apparition, that contradicts what has been divinely revealed, which is part of not private revelation, but public revelation? And then the church looks at the fruits of the apparitions, alleged apparitions, and comes to a determination whether or not these are compatible with the faith or not. When the church renders a judgment about an apparition, she doesn't say that as a matter of divine faith, you have to believe that this occurred. So she's just giving it a kind of assessment or discernment or judgment in that way. But the content of the message of the alleged apparition is not something that's added to the doctrine of the faith, the teaching of the church. So that's pretty much how the church does this. She tries to discern, looking at the recipients of the alleged apparition, looking at the content of the alleged apparition, the circumstances under which it occurs, and then sort of the fruit of it.
Does that satisfy you, Sean?
I hear and I understand what you're saying, but I guess my concern is that there's a level of deception. There is some fanaticism involved, and it seems as though the Yeah, because I've had family members that have it seems to be a distraction to their faith in Christ.
Sean, just let me get something real clear. Are you talking about a particular apparition or just Marian apparitions in general now when you say that?
No, I guess what I would call Mary worship as opposed to Christ worship, right?
Oh, okay.
Well, of course, people should not worship Mary. I mean, Mary wouldn't like that. In fact, if that's going on, that's contrary to the first commandment. Now, sometimes people will regard as Mary worship devotion to Mary. Those are not the same thing. But it's true that it is possible for someone to misunderstand the Catholic faith and give Mary the wrong place in the scheme of salvation and the plan of salvation, but that's not what the Catholic Church teaches. And of course, the Church's pastors, from the Pope and the other bishops on down to your local parish priest, would certainly correct or rebuke anybody who would say we should put Mary on the level of Jesus, we should worship Mary, yada yada yada. And if there's an apparition that would purport to justify such actions, then that would be ruled out as inauthentic because it violates the first commandment.
Well, I'm going to leave it there. I hope that that's helpful. Sean, as with anything, I suppose you can, well, maybe not any, but as with almost anything, you can overdo it. You can go too far with these things. And we don't deny that that happens as Catholics, but we do deny that that is the truth, that is true Catholic faith.
Right. That's not what the Catholic Church is calling us to. That's not what we think the Scripture means when it refers to Mary as blessed among all women, that somehow she's been elevated to divinity or something like that. We would reject that. When Jesus says to the beloved disciple at the foot of the cross, "Behold your mother," he's not saying, "Here's somebody now you're going to worship as God." So we would see that as excessive. But I want to underscore the fact that sometimes people, especially, you know, some Protestants, will look at what we would regard as authentic, even very important devotion to Mary that we would see as scripturally rooted.
Right.
And they would say, "Oh, you're worshiping Mary." And we're going to say, "No, that's a misunderstanding."
Yeah. Yeah. Mark Brumley is our guest this hour. It is Open Forum. You're welcome to call whether you're Catholic or not with any question at all about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Mark, every couple of weeks, our good friend Rochelle comes in and we talk a little bit about her podcast, a magnificent podcast called Clumsy Theosis. We commence to do that right now. Hello, Rochelle.
Hey, Cy.
And the podcast, Clumsy Theosis, available wherever you can get a high-quality podcast.
Yes, you got it right, Cy.
And as we come near the conclusion of Lent, you're talking about the Gospel of John.
Yes, we've been going through John, and a lot of people aren't aware that the Gospel of John is the first document that the Church has on all seven sacraments.
Now this excites me when you say that, because here we have Apostle John,
yes,
telling us about the seven sacraments.
Mm-hmm.
And people always ask this question, where can I find the sacraments in the Bible? Mm-hmm. So what makes you say St. John's Gospel is the first document to go through?
Yeah, in John's Gospel, he talks about the miracles that Christ performed, but he calls them signs. Right. And that right there is a clue for us, because a sign points beyond itself and then does what, Cy?
It points beyond itself to a deeper reality. And then if it's a sacramental sign, it makes that reality actual.
Yes. It fulfills what it's pointing to.
Yeah.
And so there are seven signs in John's Gospel, and each sign corresponds with a specific sacrament.
So, very good. So give me an example of a sign in a miracle,
yes,
that Jesus performs and that John calls a sign, which is different than all the other gospels. He, mm-hmm, uses the word signs. Mm-hmm. And then he's got seven of them. Give me one that corresponds to a sacrament.
Yeah. The third sign that John talks about Jesus performing is healing the paralyzed man who's in Bethesda. And so this paralyzed man, he's by the waters, which have healing power. And he's been there for 38 years. And Jesus asks him, do you want to be healed? And the man says, well, no one's been able to put me into the water. I don't have anyone to help me. And so a lot of people think that the healing that then happens after that, Jesus says, pick up your mat and walk. A lot of people think that that's pointing to baptism, but it's not.
Because it's got the water.
Exactly.
Right.
Because it's actually pointing to confession and reconciliation. Right. There's a lot there.
This is not immediately apparent to me that this is. So this is one of the seven signs. It points to the seven.
She's trying to teach you.
Oh,
she's trying to teach you.
I'll tell you what.
Not immediately apparent.
More determined minds have tried and all have failed to crack that nut. But okay. So I imagine because I have not heard the podcast this week. I imagine you will open that up for
yes.
us. How is this one in particular pointing to the sacrament of confession
exactly.
or sometimes called reconciliation?
Yeah, talk about that this Friday when the episode is released. So you'll get all the explanation as to why and how.
But last week you did the general idea.
The general
of the seven
idea.
Signs.
Mm-hmm. And I gave all of the signs and a little bit about why John used the word sign instead of miracle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the church still has seven signs.
Seven signs, yes.
Man, it's like there was some kind of spirit over all of it, making it all work together, making it all come together. They should have a name for that spirit. Seems very holy, but
yeah. The Holy Spirit, I think that you can make something happen with that, Cy.
Okay, all right. You'll see if I can get that to catch on. Clumsy theosis. Clumsy, well, you know what that means. Theosis means becoming like unto God, becoming more and more godlike.
Yes, which is what we're all called to do.
And if you don't believe it, read the second letter of St. Peter in your Bible. Clumsy theosis available wherever you get your podcasts.
Amen.
Thank you, Michelle.
All right.
Whenever morality comes up in discussions, some atheists argue the behavior patterns we call morality are merely the product of evolution, naturally selected for the survival of our species. But is this true? The answer is no, and here are some reasons why. First, if it were true God didn't exist and our moral behaviors were merely the product of evolution, well then the dictates of our evolved nature wouldn't express the will of a being beyond man. As such, there would be nothing to morally bind man's will and thus no moral obligation. Second, what if the behaviors we judge now as wrong, such as rape and murder, become beneficial for our species in the future? According to the atheistic evolutionary account, they would have to be morally acceptable. But these conclusions are absurd. Moral obligation does exist, and rape and murder will always be wrong. Therefore, evolution is not sufficient to explain morality. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
St. Paul says in the scriptures, knowledge puffs up. So I think maybe that's the connection between, unfortunately, a lot of modernity where we've discovered this intricate order to stuff and yet the rise of atheism among a lot of people. Remember when we were kids, we'd say, hey, I know a few things. My mom or dad would say, yeah, that's right. You know a few things, a very few things.
Morning Glory. Talking about everything important to today's Catholic. Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Mark Brumley, our guest this hour. Mark is the president of Ignatius Press and the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. Our number, 888-318-7884. Lots of folks on the line for you. Mark, shall we just keep working our way through them?
Let us do that.
All right, here we go. Caleb in Texas, listening on Armor of God Radio. Caleb, your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi, yes. So I need some clarification on natural family planning. So me and my wife are both in agreement on it. If the couple is deciding to not conceive that month and they're abstaining from sex, shouldn't they abstain from sex for the whole month until they're ready to start conceiving a child? Due to the fact that having intercourse is to renew your vows, and part of your vows is being open to life. I just need a clarification, because on the last episode yesterday, I thought I heard something that was in disagreement, so I wanted to clarify.
Oh, okay. So you thought, yeah, right. Because Dr. Delgado was on yesterday talking about natural family planning and made the point that you can avoid the fertile days of the month for a woman, and that is perfectly licit to do that. There's no problem with that. Your impression is that you should avoid sex for the entire month if you're not planning to conceive that month?
Right, because okay. no matter if the woman's fertile or not, or if somebody is on birth control, having a condom on, or other birth control methods that we don't agree with, if the will is there that God wants that person to have a child, he's going to make it happen, if you're using...
I think we've got it. So, Mark, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd say, as the caller implies, there are at least two ends or purposes or goods, different ways you can talk about it, associated with the marital act. One is the bringing into being, obviously God has a hand in this, bringing into being new human beings. We call that the person begetting meaning, or the person begetting end, or the person begetting good of marital relations. And there is also a person uniting good. We call that the good of union, the union of husband and wife becoming one flesh. So now, you can pursue a purpose of marital relations is to bring about or foster those two goods, but you can have a good reason, a serious reason, for not pursuing the good of new life, procreation. And therefore, you can either choose to refrain from intercourse when you think procreation is likely to occur, or you can, related to that, you can engage in intercourse when you think procreation is unlikely to occur. So long as you're not destroying, distorting the nature of the procreative act, you're not actually acting against the good of the coming into existence of a new human being. And when a husband and wife engage in marital relations during the infertile time, it's clear that they are not in their act, in their marital act, engaging in an act that is against the good of procreation, because the good of procreation is impossible at that moment. So the church regards it as morally acceptable for you to pursue the good of uniting with your spouse, the person uniting meaning of marital union, so long as in doing that you don't do it in a way that actually attacks or distorts the procreative or person begetting meaning of marital relations.
Caleb?
Sounds good. I would have to add one thing, and I know this is Old Testament and it's not likely to happen, but Sarah was able to conceive in her 90s, and that's well beyond what would be capable nowadays. So even though somebody is in their not fertile period of the month, if it is God's will for them to conceive a child during that time, it is still possible. Am I correct? Am I correct?
Well, yes. In fact, it's possible for a woman to conceive a child without marital relations. It happened. Our Lady.
Well, it also happens today with unnatural means.
But then that's an example of separating the person uniting meaning of the marital act from the life-giving or procreative meaning.
Caleb, the thing is that it is God himself who designed a woman's body to sometimes be fertile and sometimes not be fertile. So you're simply cooperating with God.
I think his point is that we may think that conception can occur, and it may in fact be the case that...
Right, I see. But it's
but God can miraculously overrule that.
Fair enough.
Or we can be mistaken and think that this is an infertile time, and in fact, still, nevertheless, conception can occur.
Caleb, thanks very, very much for that question. 888-318-7884 is the number. And Ryan in Washington watching on YouTube, you are next up with Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press. Your question, Ryan.
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I was reading, about the account in Genesis of the antediluvian period in the days of Noah, and how modern-day preachers and pastors like to apply the days of Noah to our time, especially in terms of there was an age of great violence. They tend to use that term, and they apply it to the current age. However, I read the data nowadays, and it says for centuries and centuries, violence has been in decline, all forms of violence, war, crime, and whatnot. If you look at scholar Steven Pinker's report, he'll back that up most of all. Then naturally, they'll go to abortion, and they'll say, well, it must be abortion that's causing all the violence. But naturally, we'll look at the charts, and it'll also show that abortion is declining in developed countries as well. So I'm wondering, are we misinterpreting this verse in the Bible when applying it to our days? Because it doesn't seem to add up with statistics.
Well, there's certainly no obligation to suppose that violence is increasing. That's an empirical question. Is it increasing or isn't it? Of course, a lot of it depends on how you define violence. But even assuming that we all agree on the definition of violence, there's nothing in the Bible that requires us to think that violence is going to increase.
Okay. But it just said there was a time of great violence, so people naturally think there was a bunch of lawlessness, a bunch of killing, a bunch of all this other crud going on. But, of course, we see the exact opposite nowadays. So some atheists, I've noticed, will point at that and they'll laugh and they'll be like, ha ha, look, the Bible's inconsistent and wrong about others' violence nowadays. Just look at this empirical evidence that disproves
I think there's plenty of violence still in the world. I wouldn't want to go so far as to say violence has disappeared from the globe, even if you can make a case based upon empirical evidence of a certain kind of decline. Of course, we don't really know how much violence there was in the first century or the 15th century BC. So a lot of it is speculation.
And we're pretty good at hiding violence these days, too. Mark Brumley is our guest. This is Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Be right back with more of that right after this.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Philip Rivers, NFL quarterback, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament. From the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important, this pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Mark Brumley, our guest, and I got to say the lines have just stayed full all day today, so we'll probably be moving somewhat quickly through these calls to make sure we get to everybody. Dennis in Norfolk, Virginia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Dennis, your question for Mark Brumley.
Yes, my dad wanted me to ask the question. Assuming that all the miracles of Jesus is true, how do we know that Jesus wasn't an alien?
Wow, how do we know Jesus wasn't an alien? First of all, we don't know there are aliens. So if we knew that there were aliens, I guess the question would be a live question. But since we have no indication that aliens exist, we don't even presently have any indication of life off our planet. So now it may be that there's extraterrestrial life and it's not intelligent. It may be that there is intelligent extraterrestrial life. It seems unlikely that if there is intelligent extraterrestrial life, that that life looks and sounds like us. So it's just very difficult for me to even engage this argument because it's so theoretical, you know, that Jesus was an alien when we don't even know that there are aliens, or if there are aliens, that they're intelligent. And we have good reasons to suppose from a scientific perspective that if there are intelligent aliens, that they don't look and sound like us. So I'd say that would be a reason for thinking that Jesus wasn't an alien.
Dennis, does that satisfy you?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, how do we know that Dennis wasn't an alien?
Well, so, you know,
this problem just proliferates once you start asking it. I don't.
Right.
Let's go That's to Tom right. in Indiana.
I mean, actually, I'm really an alien. I gave you that answer because I was trying to conceal the fact
that's
part of an alien invasion.
I knew it. You live right there, up there by the Starfleet Academy.
That's right, Golden Gate Park.
I had my suspicions, and now they have been confirmed.
I am from the 31st century. I've come back to mess around with the timeline.
Why'd you come back? Things going wrong in the 31st century? Okay, Tom in Indiana, listening on Redeemer Radio, you are next. Your question for the fully human Mark Brumley.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome back, Mark. Two Methodists married in the Methodist Church, both baptized, now divorced, would a Methodist wanting to marry a Catholic need an annulment?
All other things being equal, marriages between baptized persons are sacramental. And even apart from the question of sacrament, a marriage can still be a valid marriage, and therefore an annulment can still be needed, even between a baptized and an unbaptized person, or two unbaptized persons. The status of their union still has to be established. So the answer is yes.
Awesome. Okay. Terrific.
Okay.
Thank you for your help.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Oh, thanks. Thank you very much, Tom. It was nice having you here. Since Tom seems satisfied, I'm going to keep moving because, as I said, man, the lines have been full today. Joe in Mineral, Michigan, listening on 89.7 FM Annunciation Radio out of Toledo, Ohio. Joe, you are on with Mark Brumley. Your question, please.
Hi, Mark. It's actually Monroe, Michigan. Monroe.
Oh, Monroe. Okay.
Monroe, yes.
I'm going to pretend like I read that wrong. I don't want anyone to think Marie typed it in wrong. So I definitely...
Oh, man, throwing her under the
bus.
No,
that was completely me, Joe. Go ahead, your question for Mark.
So I'm actually doing historical research for the Archdiocese of Detroit, and we have kind of a unique Lenten dispensation that I believe is still in effect. Some people can still eat muskrat on Fridays. I don't know if you've heard of this before.
Oh, no, the muskrat dispensation. I had missed that, Mark.
I had missed that, too. I know it's hard to believe, but I did.
But apparently in the early 1800s, settlers were starving in the area, and a priest by the name of Father Gabriel Richard, who's actually venerable now, gave a dispensation to the people living in this area. So my question is, in the 1800s, what was meat abstinence like at that time? What were the rules regarding that?
Well, you weren't supposed to eat meat on Fridays, any Friday of the year, and you weren't supposed to eat meat during Lent, period.
Okay, so I guess that kind of makes more sense then, because obviously today we can't have meat on Fridays, but every other day we can. So if you were starving, perhaps muskrats would be essential to eat if there are rodents all over the place. So I just needed to get some confirmation on that, on that piece, because I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet.
This explains, you know, basically there was muskrat love going on then.
Muskrat Sue, and I don't remember the other muskrat's name, but Captain and Tennille could tell us. I feel like you're not taking this call from Monroe fully seriously, Mark.
I take the call fully seriously. I just think it's a great call, you know, this muskrat dispensation thing was great, and you can understand why that would happen, you know, back in the day, and if they're starving and all of that, makes a lot of sense. I just taken a kind of a my direction from your initial misreading of the name of the town that Joe was calling from.
Well, so Joe, let me ask you a question. Do you happen to know, was Michigan a mission territory at this time?
No, it was actually a territory at that time. And the Monroe County at that time was settled by French settlers from Detroit that came south. And it was kind of there was only a couple of Catholic churches in the area, and Father Gabriel Chard was at St. Anne's in Detroit. He would travel down and would see what life was like down in this way. So we're kind of close to the border to Ohio. So
that's what I was thinking, is that it wasn't a bishop that gave this dispensation. It was a priest. And so normally you would think that would be mission territory if the priest was giving the dispensation, even though I suppose any pastor could give a dispensation like that. But Joe, thanks for sharing. I still somehow don't feel like I would eat a muskrat, but Mark, any interest? No? Mm-mm. Not even as a kebab.
I mean, if you were starving, you wouldn't eat a muskrat.
Oh, no, if I was starving, I'm sorry. That should have been a qualification on that.
Describing, yes, you know, right. They weren't just saying, hey, some Tuesday night, you know.
Yeah. Well, muskrat party.
We'll get some brewskis and have some muskrat.
Connor in New York City, New York. To clarify, that is not in any other state. New York City is in New York. Your question, Connor.
Yes, New York City is, in fact, in New York.
Yeah, I knew
Thank
it.
You for clarifying, Si.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm a convert because of Catholic Answers, and I'm discerning the priesthood.
Praise
and,
God.
And I was wondering whether the priesthood is a higher calling than marriage, because I know, you know, the Council of Trent defined marriage to be to not be a higher calling than the priesthood, but are they equal? Is priesthood a higher calling than marriage? You know, I hear a lot of people, you know, say a lot of things.
Well, you're just going to have another person say something here. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, but you're the authoritative person.
This is somewhat disputed theological question. I think there's a general sense in which many theologians, I won't say most, but many will say that the priesthood is a higher calling in that for most people, you know, most human beings, most men, it is quite a sacrifice to be celibate. And that means refraining from sexual relations and also refraining from marriage. Now, those two normally go together, but they're distinguishable. And that for most men, that those elements are very difficult. Okay, that's first point. But second point, to live a life, whether you're married or not, because we know that there were priests who are married, not generally in the Roman Rite, but there are some in the Eastern Rite and some exceptions in the Roman Rite too, that, you know, to configure your life to Christ with respect to the ministerial priesthood requires an immense number of sacrifices that are challenging for most men. And so in that sense, we can think of it as a higher state of life, but we don't want to push that too far, because there are graces that come with that, and some individual men are better disposed to live the single life and better disposed to conform their lives to the pattern of Jesus's priesthood. So we don't want to make, you know, a universal statement. We're distinguishing between what we might call an objective sense, sense in which objectively to give up a family, to do all of the things that are necessary to be a priest and to conform one's life to Christ as priest, objectively speaking, that those are challenging to most men. Whatever the case may be, and in the instance of any particular individual male in his subjective preparation.
All right,
help.
Does that help you, Connor?
Yeah, that does help me. It's just what do you think that the church needs more married men who are like good fathers and have a bunch of kids who raise a bunch of Catholics, or they need more priests?
Oh, I think, well, it's very difficult to say which there's a greater need of. Only God knows. But obviously we need both.
And good luck having one without the other.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, just looking around, when we look at the pastoral needs of parishes today, it certainly is not an unreasonable thing to discern or to judge that there's a shortage of priests, that is to say, to carry out all the responsibilities that we expect of priestly ministry in the church today. We need more boots on the ground. So I don't, you know, people say, well, God gives us the number of priests that we need. I think that's a little bit simplistic because God also acts with, you know, what God wills, he wills with an awareness of human freedom and how people are going to respond. So I believe that God is probably calling some men to the priesthood and they're not listening. So is God going to sit around and wait for them? Well, God is ever patient, but he carries out his plans regardless of how we respond. So I would say, yeah, there's a need for more priests in the church. And, of course, we always need good, solid Catholic laymen.
So there you are, Connor.
How long after converting do you think somebody should think about entering seminary?
I think that's a question that really requires discernment between the individual and, say, his pastor or the local vocations director. I wouldn't want to – I mean, I can make a general observation that I don't think people who are newly converted or newly come into full communion with the Catholic Church – should right away pursue priesthood, because there can be – it's possible that someone's zeal for the Catholic faith can be confused with a zeal – with a priestly vocation, a calling to the priesthood. And so I think broadly speaking, there should be a period of discernment. But it can vary with individuals. I've known people who've come into the church and then very quickly thereafter pursued priesthood and were ordained and so on. So I think a lot of it depends on the individual, and it should be discerned. The individual should discern that with spiritual guidance from pastor or vocations director.
Connor, thank you very, very much for that call. I will tell you this, our chaplain's out of the country at the moment, but if you ever want to call here and just ask for some time to talk with Father Hugh Barber, this is something he's done his whole adult life, is help men make these decisions. He might give you a little further help. I have to apologize to Muskrat Sam. I remembered Muskrat Susie, but I just now I'm remembering Muskrat Sam.
Boy, gee.
I know, but he's a very... he's a loving guy, Muskrat Sam. So
I mean,
feel
the fact that you remembered him at all, I think, is notable.
Thank you.
I commend you.
Thank you very much. It had nothing to do with the internet on my computer. Annual spring store-wide sale underway right now at shop.catholic.com. Enter promo code SPRING19 at checkout and save 15% off everything in the store when you check out. SPRING19 at shop.catholic.com. Get 15% off everything right now.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
What makes me happy is listening to Catholic radio. I'm by myself a lot. Had a concussion as a child and I can't see very well, but I do work. I go to church and I'm an on-fire convert. And as a child, more or less, I've learned to have a good sense of humor whenever I can. And I'm very appreciative of everything I have, and especially Catholic radio.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Having a lot of fun with Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, the most substantial Catholic publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. And it is open forum today. You can call and ask Mark any question you want in any language you want. Zachary in Newcastle, Indiana, watching on YouTube Live. You are up next. Your question for Mark, Zachary.
Hi, thanks for taking my question, guys. My question is, so I know a lot of people who will say that Catholics worship Mary, and the distinction is that, no, it's not worship, it's devotion to Mary. What exactly is it that gives that distinction between worship and devotion? Like, where is the line that you cross from devotion into worship? And I guess you could apply that to all the saints, because that's a question that I get a lot from people.
Okay.
Okay. That's very good. Now, let me just do a little bit of a clarification. You know, in the old days, the word worship, old days, 100 years ago, let's say, the word worship just meant to acknowledge the worship, the worth of someone. And, you know, even today, magistrates in some countries have been called, you know, your worship as a title. It just means I'm acknowledging the worship of this person. Okay. But because there's a lot of confusion, the kind of devotion that's due to God alone, which we call adoration, and the kind of devotion that it can be given to created beings, if you use the same term to refer to both of those, it's apt to generate confusion. And since there are already people who think that Catholics regard Mary and or the other saints as divine, we treat them as if they were God, it probably is best not to use the word worship in any way, shape, or form in connection to the devotion that's given to a creature, even though there's a perfectly legitimate, old-fashioned, even non-Catholic use of that term. So then the question is, if we're going to use the word worship to refer to the kind of devotion that is due to God alone, then what's the word we're going to use otherwise? And we often use the word devotion. We speak of honoring the saints. You know, in Latin, we make a distinction between latria, which is a kind of acknowledgement of God and that he is supreme, that he's above all, that any other good that any other being has ultimately comes from him. So that's latria. That's what we call adoration, or the worship of adoration. And then there's the honoring of created beings, the greatest of which, or of whom, is Our Lady. We call that dulia, and with respect to Our Lady, the Latin word we use, hyperdulia, meaning that there's a super-duper kind of honoring that we give to her. We acknowledge that she has, but we also acknowledge goodness and greatness in other created beings. So the real distinction between if we want to use the word worship and the word devotion, is the object or the one who is being honored or venerated or acknowledged. In the case of God, he's supreme above everything and everyone, and he demands our absolute obedience, our absolute acknowledgement, our absolute valuing above any and everything else and anyone else. And then everything else, it gets valued appropriate to the goodness that God has endowed it with, or endowed him with, or her with. So I think that's the difference. Does that help, Zachary?
Yeah, that does. Thank you.
All right, Zachary, thank you very, very much. Let us go to Jessica in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Jessica, your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, Jessica, your question.
Yes.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so I have two questions. The first question, I'll just ask both of them, and then if you have time to answer both, great. If not, no big deal. My first question, though, is what exactly are vocations? What's meant by that? What are they? And then my second question is there some type of a good resource that's kind of like a dictionary or a glossary that would help somebody coming back to the church or somebody that's not?
Okay. All right. We got so the first, just because it was a little bit hard to hear you, the first question is, what does the word vocation mean? Basically, what's a vocation?
And second, vocation means calling.
All right.
And there are different kinds of vocation. There's the universal vocation or calling to become a saint that everybody has. Every human being on the planet is intended by God to become a saint. So that's a universal calling. Then there are particular vocations that have to do with states of life. So some of us are called to be laity. Some of us are called to ordained life, to be deacons, priests, or bishops. Some of us are called to live a radical way of life in religious life, to represent or anticipate the radical life of the age to come, where we won't be married and we won't need possessions and our wills will be wholly surrendered to God. So we call that a religious vocation. And then beyond that, there are particular callings that we may have, you know, whether you're a priest or a layman. I think Cy is called to be a layman. He's a married man, layman. He's also, I think, called to work at Catholic Answers. And of course, Cy is called, as we are all called, to be holy. So that's the sense in which we refer to vocation.
Okay,
with respect to resources for terminologies of faith, the Catechism of the Catholic Church is a good one. If you get the big green version of it, there's a glossary in the back. I think Father John Harden's Catholic Dictionary is still out there. There are other Catholic Dictionary resources that are available. I think OSV still publishes their Catholic Dictionary, so I would recommend those.
So would you say it was Father – what was Father Harden's first name?
John Harden.
Father John –
Harden, H-A-R-D-O-N.
And it's a Catholic Dictionary. Yeah. And the reason I wanted to get that clear is after the show, the wonderful Nick Chamberlain posts all of the resources that have been suggested in the show notes. So you can go to the show page and just find those notes. If you need Jessica, we'll have that for you. So there's a glossary in the back of the printed form of the catechism.
The big green one.
Oh, the big green cat. Oh, it's got to be the big green one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Jessica, thank you. I'm going to keep moving. I want to try to get everybody in. Bob in Farmington Hills, Michigan. You are up next. Bob, your question for Mark Brumley.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. Very quickly, my wife's in a nursing home. It's a Catholic church across the street. And the woman there that's, I guess, a Eucharistic minister brought in the Eucharist to the nursing home, but she brought it in during dinner time. Mm-hmm. Everybody was eating dinner, and she gave people the Eucharist while they were eating dinner. Now,
yeah,
I refused that for my wife and myself, and she called me old-fashioned.
Well, you are supposed to observe a Eucharistic fast, and, you know, the extraordinary minister of Holy Communion should, to the best of her ability, try to coordinate giving the Blessed Sacrament with what's going on as far as dinner and other meals. That's respect for the Blessed Sacrament, and that's what should happen. Now, I don't know the details of this situation other than what you told me, so that's what I would say.
Okay, Bob, thanks. I'm going to keep moving, trying to get everybody in. Mel in Canada, watching on YouTube Live. Thanks for calling from Canada, Mel. Your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi there. I came across an interesting topic yesterday. It's called preterism. They claim that Jesus came back in the year 70 AD, and they use a bunch of verses, of course. And I thought it was pretty convincing, but suspicious because, you know, Catholic Church goes back to the first century. So I just want to know, does the Catholic Church teach preterism, that he came back, or is his second coming literally just the second time at the end of the age?
All right, preterism. What do we
– different types of preterism, but the main idea is that the Catholic Church is that Jesus will come again. We can think of Jesus as that the destruction of the temple in AD 70 was a divine judgment. In that sense, you know, the Son of Man came, but that doesn't exclude or – it doesn't exclude Jesus coming at the end of the world. That's the really big coming. That's the second coming. So there's a sense in which preterism is onto something by seeing a divine visitation in history. Those things certainly can happen, are possible, and do happen. But we don't want to limit the second coming to something that happened in AD 70.
Okay, Mel?
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Got it.
Omar in Arizona, you're last up. Do you think you can make the question real quick for Mark?
Yeah. So I was wondering, how can I convert a Mormon friend to Catholicism? And can I get any tips on how to do that?
Got any tips for converting Mormons?
Pray, know your faith well, and try to understand their concerns. One of their concerns is a great apostasy, the claim that the early church was great and then it went astray, and it was, the faith was restored by Joseph Smith in the 19th century. By showing continuity between what the earliest Christians taught and the Catholic Church, at least in broad strokes, I think you can show that the claim of a great apostasy can't be sustained. So that's the way I would begin. But I'd also, pray for your friend and be a good friend to him. Show him by the example of your Christian living that you know who Christ is and that you're not part of a great apostasy, but you're part of a continuity, a great continuity with New Testament Christianity.
A great continuity. I like that. I'm going to definitely use that. Omar, thank you so much. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, thank you for a very fine hour.
Cy, thank you, and I look forward to talking to you again, hopefully from the Alpha Quadrant.
And maybe over a nice plate of muskrat.
There you go.
Tomorrow, I think we got the kids open forum tomorrow. Is that right, Nick? Yeah, Nick says, yeah, kids open forum. If you're a kid, give us a call tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.
BreadBox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.
CMF Curo is the country's first Catholic healthcare ministry to provide an affordable health sharing solution rooted in Catholic teaching and community. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast. That's mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast.